It was just like running them down, just step on.
Good morning.
Okay. Good. Welcome, everyone. Today is March 14th, 2017. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Have another full agenda, and apparently we got 12 more bills referred to us last night. So we're going to plow ahead.
Wow.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3012 and invite Representative Leininger, Representative Meek, and Charlotte Lehan to the dais. Cassie, could you please read a summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3012 allows the construction of a new single-family dwelling on a parcel of land zoned for residential use if an existing historic home is present on the site and converted into an accessory dwelling unit. The bill prohibits the owner from constructing a new single-family dwelling, from subdividing the lot or parcel apart from the ADU, doing renovations, increasing the square footage by 120%, and rebuilding the ADU if the structure is lost to a fire.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, which is Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and I'm delighted to be here today on a bill that is co-sponsored by Representative Meek and Representative Stark and I, and thank you, both of you, for being part of this team. The goal of this bill, and former Clackamas County Chair Charlotte Lehan will speak to it, as will Representative Meek, is to support our broad-based effort this session to address access to affordable housing by taking a tact that is essentially to not require the waste of existing housing units on rural residential land by removing a necessity that when an owner buys a parcel and wants to build, say, a dream home on that parcel, but there's already a modest home or a historic structure on the parcel, by eliminating the requirement that they essentially destroy the existing structure and instead enabling, which is currently the status of the law in rural residential, and instead enabling the owners of that parcel to continue operating and even to do improvements to, at a limited degree, to the existing structure and operate it as rental housing. Now, the bill as written would enable the landowners to make improvements up to 120% of the existing footprint and make sure the structure is not falling down. They wouldn't require you to convert it into, say, a chicken coop. You wouldn't be able to partition the land and then sell the other structure. So it would safeguard the desire to not parcelize rural land that is currently embodied in that land use designation, but it would support access to affordable housing in rural parts of our state, not through a top-down regulatory system, but rather by letting people not waste the real estate value that they currently have. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues here in whichever order you want to speak and make sense.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm very happy to name is Mark Meek, for the record, representative for House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone, Jennings Lodge, and unincorporated Clackamas County. And I'm very proud and happy to help to be sitting here today and helping support this bill. As a realtor and somebody that has helped families purchase properties like this, it is very sad when they do want to build their dream home and they're going to have to destroy this very valuable property that may not meet their needs for their family at that, because it may be only 1,000 square feet or very small. This would be an opportunity for them to, in most cases, they live in the unit, that house, they build their dream home, and then when they're completed, the zoning requires them to destroy and demolish the building. So in this case, it would be a fantastic opportunity to preserve the property, preserve the character of the neighborhoods or the communities that it lives, that this property is in, and then allow, you know, a homeowner to build their property, live in it, and with our new societal changes, maybe not a rental, but maybe somebody from their family. It could be for a mother-in-law, father-in-law, sons and daughters. You know, it's just a great new opportunity. And so that's why I support this. I think it'd be a fantastic, and it won't delineate our farm use properties, exclusive farm use. This is rural residential zone properties. And so that's why I support it, and hopefully we're able to get this passed. So thank you very much, Chair Kenny.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Charlotte Lehan. I've served in local and government for close to 30 years, and nearly all that time I have been a strong advocate of Oregon's land use planning laws. I am also an advocate for Oregon history and heritage, and I currently serve on the Oregon Historic Marker Committee and the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries and other things, but it pains me that they have kind of come in conflict. So over the years, I watch as one after another of these older, small farmhouses just disappear off the landscape and are replaced by dream homes, you know, 4,000 square foot plus houses, and the old little farmhouse is gone, and we lose a lot of our heritage along with it. I think this bill is carefully crafted to provide the private incentive to maintain these structures as residential units, and at the same time, it does not incentivize over-improvement because it's not divisible. You can't, it doesn't lend itself to someone coming in and using it to flip for quick cash. It only is maintainable as an ADU, as an accessory to the primary dwelling unit. I think it improves housing choice because we maintain some of these smaller units that that right now are being required to be removed in favor of the much larger dwelling unit, and so they disappear. I think, and I agree with everything the other speakers have said in terms of what flexibility it allows to do that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yep. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Ann Leininger again. I wanted to note, and I think we'll be hearing from some of these folks, that in the process of developing this bill, and thank you to City Councilor Charlotte Lehan for coming up with the idea, bringing the idea forward to me in the first place. We've talked to the Realtors, Thousand Friends, and Farm Bureau all about this idea and incorporated input from them as we structured what the scope of the bill would be. And it's my understanding that there is not any opposition to the bill, but we can certainly test that hypothesis.
we will be. Are there questions for this panel? I have a quick question, and probably to you, Charlotte, because you're a big historic advocate. This is defined, a historic home is defined as a dwelling constructed between 1850 and 1950, and I'm just curious how you came to those numbers. What if something was 1830, for instance?
Well, I really don't think we have any structures left that are pre-1850. Okay. I think the oldest lumber stick-built house is what I understand is in Silverton is the old gear house, and it's like an 1851.
Okay.
But certainly, if someone discovered one that was even older, but the likelihood is small that we have an actual structure that is habitable.
Okay.
That was built before 1850.
Okay, great. And then 1950, that was just
and 1950, I'm not entirely stuck on that, but I think as you come forward, there are two things that happen. One is you start getting into the manufactured home situation, which doesn't much exist before 1950.
Okay.
And many more, much higher percentage of the houses built after 1950 are habitable in today's sense. They have more than one bathroom. They have, you know, three or four bedrooms. They can be made functional without building another one. The problem with these older farm homes is they're frequently only two bedrooms and one bathroom. They just don't fit the needs of most families today, and they're like was said, they're more in the 1,000 to 1,200 square foot range. So they are, that's why we have to make some effort, excuse me, to save them. And more recent vintage houses, I think, save themselves, shall we say, are not as, don't come with the same kind of baggage.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So next panel, Mary Kyle McCurdy, Marianne Nash, and Becky Stecker.
Good.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Deputy Director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. We appreciate the outreach that Representative Leininger has done to our organization on this bill and City Councilor Charlotte Lehan. And we support it because of its limited impact and the trade-off with preserving historic housing. It offers a limited opportunity to preserve historic homes in rural residential areas that are actually auxiliary to the main house, and that historic structure must actually be restored as a house. And so those are defined, the term historic is defined, the house must be actually restored and has to be ancillary to an additional house built on the piece of property. Because we think it will have very limited impact on rural residential areas and on farming in the area, we found that a reasonable trade-off. Thank you.
Thank you. Sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nash, here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I echo much of what Mary Kyle said. We appreciate the opportunity to work with Representative Leininger on this bill. As you'll hear in the coming hour, we have significant concerns about siting additional housing on farmland and appreciate her working with us to narrow this back to rural residential lands and make sure that, as Mary Kyle said, I think it's the optimal trade-off between protecting farming while still allowing some additional housing opportunities and appropriate areas where other uses would be impacted. So, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Becky Steckler, and I am the Program and Policy Manager for the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association. And I think we looked at this bill kind of in total with all of the other bills that are before you this morning that would increase housing out on either rural residential or EFU. And we opposed the bill as it was laid out, and I understand some of the limited impact that it may have, but it kind of begged the question for us of why are we trying to increase additional housing out in unincorporated areas? And we're definitely swayed by some of the work that was done by the Association of Oregon Counties, or Oregon County Planning Directors Association, and thinking about both the pros of providing housing, but then also the cons of putting additional housing out in rural areas where you're farther away from different kinds of public services, or you're providing a greater impact on those public services, such as roads and schools and emergency services that might not be designed for that, as well as if you're really putting that, you know, and thinking about it in the terms of affordable housing, then you're trading off the cost of housing for the cost of transportation and putting those people farther away from potentially their employment and schools and shopping and the other things that they have to get to. And then also, I guess the question was raised as well of what is rural and what is urban. The Supreme Court in the Curry County case back in the 1980s said that for an area to be rural, that it would be one housing unit for with a minimum of a 2-acre lot. And so, again, kind of all of these bills were increasing that density. And so I wonder how it holds up against that Supreme Court case. While some of these houses might be fairly small and you can redefine it as an accessory dwelling unit, it does, in essence, provide an additional housing unit out in unincorporated areas, and this does increase that density. So there's some of those issues to think as well. And again, I think the planning directors also came up with some important sideboards to make sure that the legislation would think about, such as septic systems and the making sure that the building, the housing units can all comply with DEQ's septic, as well as availability of housing and not requiring additional wells to be drilled and things of that nature. So those are just some of the concerns that if this bill does go forward, we would hope that you would consider and potentially amend the legislation. Thank you.
So you signed up as neutral. You have concerns. You see pros and... Is that right? Oh, no, you signed up as against. I'm sorry. Okay, so you're against... and if it goes forward, you might want to see an amendment with additional sideboards.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Speaker Kotek, can you wait for two more speakers on this bill so we can wrap up this bill? You okay? All right. We have Sean Cleave and John Chandler.
Good
I'm assuming you have fairly short comments, because I know she has to.
Madam Chair, I can be exceptionally short. Okay. It's Mr. Chandler that's belabored it.
I was more looking at him.
Total drive-by, Madam
Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Association of Realtors, in support of House Bill 3012. I just want to point out for the record, rural residential is probably a really small fraction of the amount of houses that are out there that could be redeveloped under this a similar philosophy. I have a little bit of deja vu because this was an issue I was working on for Farm Bureau when I left service for that organization in 2009. So to that extent, I think that there's a few things that we should be considering as amendments to 3012, specifically how this interplays with the metro, rural, and urban reserves. There might be some densification that occurs that maybe shouldn't in those reserve areas that would prohibit future development at greater densities. But with that, definitely open to the concept. One thing that you might consider also for if you want to expand this, which the relating to clause would allow in farm zones, you know, what you end up with is a lot of property owners holding on to a property that's derelict and probably should be torn down, but they're holding on to it specifically because they think maybe there's an opportunity in the future for me to rehab this property or tear it down and rebuild as my primary residence. I think the same philosophies in 3012 kind of hold true to that. At a minimum, you might want to consider doing a lot of record so that you're encouraging the farmer in those cases to tear down that derelict property where there is a variety of nasty things that occur, vandalism, drug use, high school kids going out partying, stuff like that. You just have to drive out in rural Washington County to kind of get an idea for what those properties look like. Beautiful as they may, they are a little bit of a public nuisance. And with that, I will close my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of 3012. We had actually considered bringing a bill similar to the one that you're going to hear here in a little bit on accessory dwelling units. Did not do so because Marion County brought theirs forward, which I'll speak to when it comes up. I was blissfully unaware that you could not do ADUs in rural residential prior to being called to my attention, so I applaud the committee for looking at various takes on the same issue. There's also a Senate bill that I believe Senator Mona Anderson is going to introduce if she hasn't done so already on the same topic. And in general, we're very supportive of anything that allows more houses to be built. I do share the concern Mr. Cleave mentioned that we don't inadvertently create rings of low-density development that becomes almost impossible to densify later. And so perhaps some sort of tie back to the urban reserves where they've been designated as a carve-out against this. Otherwise, you do end up with potentially rings of very difficult to redevelop development around a city, then you have to leapfrog for future urban use. That's not the intention, I understand, but that could easily be one of the unintended consequences. But with that said, I think the notion of letting people in rural residential zones where you're not affecting the natural resource base, they've already been taken out of the farmland designation, to use them more effectively and efficiently and to allow for family members to care for each other and that sort of thing makes all sorts of sense. So we're happy to be here supporting the bill. Tempting though it is, given the array of the previous panel of the APA, 1000 Friends and Farm Bureau being on the other side, by force of habit, I was tempted to come up here and oppose the bill, but I'll stifle that. It does make the analysis much easier, but I'll withdraw. Be glad to take any questions.
Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3012, open a public hearing on House Bill 2007, and invite up Madam Speaker. Cassie, could you give us a summary of the bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2007 requires a city or county with affordable housing stock of less than 10% to review housing development applications for permit, limited land use, or zone change, and specifies the application qualifications. The bill allows the Land Use Board to reverse or remand a city or county application decision. House Bill 2007 also directs Housing and Community Services Department, OHCS, to develop and implement a program to produce housing development designs for single-family dwellings with an accessory dwelling unit affordable to income equal or less than 80% of the median family income for the county, and 5 housing development designs affordable to incomes equal to or less than 60% of the median family income for the county. The bill requires OHCS to develop program rules for implementation of the housing development design program, and requires Department of Consumer and Business Services to review and approve housing development designs from OHCS. The bill requires cities and counties with populations of 25,000 or fewer receiving the DCBS-approved housing development design to review and approve applications within 30 days. House Bill 2007 also requires a city to allow affordable housing dwelling in non-residential places of worship on real property. Declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, for the record, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, Speaker of the House. Good morning. Nice to see you again. I'll be here twice this week, so I'm very excited. Welcome to Housing Supply Day. Wanted to talk about House Bill 2007 today. As I've been mentioning when I'm before this committee, we need short-term and long-term solutions. We're obviously dealing with the tenant side of the conversation in the rental market, but we all know there's a supply problem. And this is a bill to bring together a set of ideas on how to improve development of housing in our state. Based on the 2016 data, our state economist estimates that Oregon would have needed to triple our production of units to keep pace with new demand. Therefore, if demand stays the same in 2017, we would need to build over 57,000 units just to keep even with the demand of new residents, and an additional 54,000 units to make up for the deficit of the last 10 years. In total, we would need to build over 111,000 new units statewide in 2017 alone, almost 6 times the number of units that were permitted last year. So, long way to go. So with that, and that doesn't even get to the affordable side of this. As we know, HCS has said we have 150,000 unit shortage for families who earn 50% of the average median income. So while we cannot build our way out of this crisis immediately, we do need to take steps to reduce the current shortage. So at the state level, before I get into the bill, I do want to say that we're going to do everything we can this session to continue to invest resources in building affordable housing. If we have resources, I hope we can do another $100 million into the LIFT program to build more low-income housing. Certainly, we want to remove barriers to development, make it easier. I've had varying conversations over the last couple months with developers about what the barriers are to building more housing, not just affordable, but market rate. And so what you have before you today is an attempt to take a stab at some of those barriers that are inhibiting our ability to build quickly. So House Bill 2007 does 4 things. First, it requires cities and counties to prioritize affordable housing projects in their permitting process. And for the record, affordable housing is defined in the bill as 60% of median family income. State law currently requires jurisdictions to review and determine the applicability of a construction application within 120 days. So this bill doesn't change that. But what it does say that if it's a housing project, it should go to the top of the line in terms of permitting. So that's number one. Number two, it allows developers who have had a project denied for a design review element to appeal the decision to the Land Use Board of Appeals. One of the most common barriers we hear from developers about why they can't build and build quickly is because of not in my backyard. The NIMBY aspect of, I don't like the way it looks, I don't want it to be there, it's too high. And we're in a crisis, so we have to provide another avenue to get past some of the design review issues. The bill would currently exempt communities with at least 10% of affordable housing in their existing supply. So if you're doing better than most in terms of affordable housing supply, this would not apply to you. So this is clearly an incentive to say, well, we value design review, but we have to have more affordability unless we're going to, you know, have this appeal to LUBA available for developers. Third item, the bill would direct the Department of Housing and Community Services to work to develop model housing plans. What we have heard is, why don't we make it easier? Why don't we come up with a set of templates of housing plans that are pre-approved, that could be designed and approved by the state and through the Building Codes Division, and then just be ready to roll. So, and we would allow those to be used in smaller communities, defined in the bill as 25,000 or less, but certainly up for debate. And then if a developer in those communities decides to use one of those model plans, it would have to be permitted within 30 days. So we're trying to, you know, provide different tools out there to get things moving. And lastly, the bill would allow adding affordable housing to what church-owned land could be used for. Because currently there's a variety of things, as you'll see in the bill, that are approved on church land but not housing. And I don't know how much that will be used. I do have a church in my district that is trying to build on their property in North Portland because they want to provide more affordable housing. So, again, trying to make it easier if there is land out there that a church might want to build on for housing. So we have gotten lots of feedback on this bill since it came out. There's an amendment in the works. We have stakeholders from both the land use community and the development community giving us feedback, so there will be some changes. But we wanted to get this started and look forward to the testimonies today. And if you have any questions, happy to answer. But, again, I think what you're going to hear from other people is this is a good start. We just need to probably tweak it a bit.
Good. Any questions? Thank you.
Yeah, so thank much. You. Good luck.
We got have you out morning. Of here before 8:30.
Yeah, thank
okay,
you.
Good. So next up, we have Mike Kinsella, Mary Kyle McCurdy, and John Chandler.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Kinsella, Executive Director of Oregon Locus, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2007. Oregon Locus is the first statewide affiliate of Smart Growth America's Coalition of Responsible Developers and Investors. Our organization is made up of largely urban infill, mixed-use, and transit-oriented developers across the state who are deeply passionate about advancing the principles of smart growth in their communities. Oregon Locus is focused on collaborating with city, county, and state-level policymakers throughout Oregon to achieve a variety of innovative policy solutions that address our region's housing and land use needs through a lens of economic, social, and environmental sustainability. That is why we appreciate Speaker Kotek's leadership and sponsorship of House Bill 2007. The bill works with the private sector, far and away the largest generator of housing in Oregon, to encourage more housing affordability by getting at one of the most significant barriers, lengthy approval processes. Lengthy approval processes add significant cost for any housing development. However, in the case of affordable housing projects, which frequently have complex capital structures and a multitude of participants, long approval times can literally sink a deal. House Bill 2007 addresses this issue in several important ways. First, the bill puts projects that have an affordable housing component at the front of the line. This is an important concept. In application, it is important to have more clarity on what achieves this requirement. It makes sense that the priority comes at initial application or among similar types of applications and not necessarily at each recheck. It is concerning if one complex of affordable housing with 25 units can go through all of its rechecks and reviews before any market projects that may have hundreds of units are considered. The second process improvement is that any application for housing must be acted on within 120 days, unless the applicant asks for more time. This element alone creates a significant improvement in certainty and cost reduction for housing. Unfortunately, the statute cited for this very helpful 120-day timeline for acting on an application has an exemption for applications within urban growth boundaries. And ORS 197, which applies to local jurisdictions with UGBs, does not have a deadline for acting on approvals. These are the very areas that most frequently have approval processes that can take 18 to 24 months before ground even breaks. This bill will be much more effective if all jurisdictions work within the 120-day window, or at least a set window of some type. We also recognize that there may be jurisdictions that do not currently have staff and or expertise to implement this accelerated process, and we encourage the availability of grants and technical assistance for those jurisdictions. Third, the bill recognizes that LUBA puts a great deference on cities' land use decisions within its comp plan and comp plan goals. But when those decisions are made based on design review, that is a subjective matter rather than a land use issue and should not be a barrier to affordable housing projects. Those design review cases should not be appealable to LUBA, as its focus should be exclusively on land use and limited land use decisions. We encourage the bill to be expanded to address all appeals to LUBA that are based on the design review portion of the application. In our experience, it is NIMBY-motivated entities, not cities, that tend to appeal housing projects to LUBA based on design review issues. And although there is LUBA deference to a city decision, the length of time involved in holding a city's approval, again, can sink an affordable housing project. LUBA should be able to decline to hear the approval of a city-approved project if the appeal is based on design review portion of the application. There is a related matter that we'd also like to see addressed through House Bill 2007. Affordable housing projects appealed to LUBA can face additional months of delay when record objections are filed on the last day. In many cases, these objections to the record are not valid and are filed for purposes of delay, which increases costs and the likelihood that the project, the affordable housing project, will not move forward. This delay could be reduced dramatically by providing a notice of record objection, working to resolve it in good faith, and limiting those objections to material issues in the actual record or new issues in supplemental record. Last, the concepts around pre-approved designs for small population areas and allowing places of worship to allow affordable housing development are promising, and we support those as well. Oregon Locus urges your support of House Bill 2007. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler again on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association and here by proxy for 1,000 Friends of Oregon as well. Ms. McCurdy had to go next door for another set of bills. Historically, the Home Builders and 1,000 Friends, when it has come to issues within the urban growth boundary, have by and large agreed far more often than we have disagreed. Where the disagreements have occurred in years past have been over UGB related. But when it comes to actually making the system work inside UGBs, where land is supposed to be developed at certain densities and certain price ranges according to statute, we are on the same page, and I'm pleased to be able to speak, since she isn't here, on both behalves. She has a letter in the record on OLS I'd commend to you. And we're also here very supportive of 2007 and very deeply appreciative of the Speaker's understanding and willingness to tackle the very difficult issue of making sure that the laws already on the books are complied with. We do have a supply problem. As she indicated, this has been one that's been plaguing us in building for many years, and part of it is, frankly, and you've heard me talk about this in different contexts on other bills, that we've got plenty of law on the books. In fact, when I was getting ready to prepare for this session, trying to figure out a way to get the production numbers up to the extent that was within the ability of the legislature to do so, I realized there really wasn't much to come up with other than what we'd come up with in years past. What we needed to do was to make sure that people were following the rules that had already been written. Clear and objective standards is one of those. We have a bill being dropped by Representative Johnson as a priority dealing with that. It'll probably come to your committee. I'll hold testimony on it till there's actually something to talk about. But we're trying, with that piece of legislation, which is, I think, indicated also by 2007, trying to move cities and the citizens of cities to understand that you have to have a path. If you have land inside of urban growth boundaries that is supposed to be developed, then by extension, it should be developable in a timely and efficient process. The issue that that has been identified by the Speaker in 2007 of site design review is another critical issue. That goes to clear and objective standards, because you can have all the standards you want as long as they're clear. When you get into compatibility, character of the neighborhood, and more amorphous things like color and architectural features, it's impossible to comply with those in a timely fashion, and all sorts of fodder for appeals and delay. And as already been indicated by my colleague here, it isn't necessarily that the developer loses, it's the developer runs out of money or runs out of the grant window or runs through an option or simply gets disgusted and quits. And if you're an opponent to a project that you don't want in your neighborhood, that's sufficient. You don't have to have victory in the legal sense. You have to have victory in a practical sense. That then flies in the face of Oregon land use planning and trying to get cities to densify, create keep the urban growth boundary tight and create livable communities. We are looking forward to working with the Speaker. We and 1,000 Friends have met with her staff. We are working on some amendments to make this bill better, to improve it. the notion of the direction is going, though, is absolutely the right one. And whether it's this bill, our bill, or some other bill yet in front of you, we simply have to act not just on the theory, but on the practice of making sure that land zoned for development can, in fact, produce the units for which it's designated at the price ranges for which the planning was done. And if that can't be done, then the planning needs to be changed so that it matches up with reality. But this impossible situation in which we find ourselves, where a 10-unit project turns into a 6-unit project, and those 4 units are never picked up anyplace else in the system, is part of what's driving the housing crisis we have in front of us. I'm excited. I've been doing this a long time, as some of you know, and the fact that we can come in here with Thousand Friends, with the speaker, with others, to try to move a set of bills, or one bill perhaps, forward that really gets its hands around the issue of housing supply would be a good bit of work for this legislature. I'm looking forward to being part of it. Glad to take any questions.
Great. Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Chair Kinney-Geyer. So thanks for your testimony, Mr. Chandler. I have a question. I don't really, I'm not part of the housing development application ecosystem, so I don't really know how that process works. So I'm sure you do. But if you create a situation where in order for me to get my application to the front of the line, I just have to have one affordable unit in there, do you create a situation where people are putting one affordable unit in a 100-unit development to just jump to the front of the line, and then creating people who are stuck constantly starving at the back of the line? Is that a possibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, in terms of the amendments that are coming forward, I believe one of them will be addressing that point. And we do have concern about any time you move to the front of the line, that implies somebody's moving to the back of the line. That, to me, is something that needs to be refined. It's not a fatal flaw. It's simply to get that to lined up. I don't think that's the intention. I don't think the intention is to have market rate projects languish. It's to get everything moving faster. How many affordable units would be necessary to trigger the preferential treatment is a question. And frankly, local capacity is an issue. One of the things in 2007 that I think could use some work is putting a shorter time frame. We have a 120-day rule right now that is on the books. It gets honored in the breach, but it's on the books that jurisdictions have to complete the work within 120 days. That's pretty fast, and to go faster than that usually requires more resources. And so to tell cities you got to go fast, full stop, is probably unfair, because particularly a smaller city doesn't have the people to keep up with the workload they have. But that's the sort of thing, in working with the speaker's office, we hope to refine, because I think the intention anyway is to get everything going through faster, with affordable going through with a special dispensation, or perhaps less opportunity for neighbors to tangle it up. There was a case in Southern Oregon, I'll get it somewhat, the fact's probably incorrect, but the point I think will be clear, that was a piece of litigation some years ago where a condo project was proposed. Everybody loved it. It was market rate. The city liked it. Neighbors liked it. Everybody liked it. And then the developer went under, as it happened to a fair number of my clients during the downtime, and the housing authority bought the property and proposed essentially the same project, same footprint, same size, same units, but with poor folks in it instead of rich folks, and all of a sudden nobody liked it anymore. And litigation ensued, and the housing authority won. But the point is that oftentimes, particularly as projects are seen to be more affordable by neighborhoods, they tend to be opposed where they might not be opposed if they weren't, and that's where you get into the issues of design review. So I think the intention here is to strip off those kind of things, whether it's a time factor and you get to go to the front of the line, or simply these criteria, you go faster with them or something, I think is clearly what they're trying to do, which we would support wholeheartedly.
Good. I'll look forward to seeing the amendments.
Yeah.
Welcome to the ecosystem, Representative.
Good question, Representative. I had the exact same thought when I read that. Any other questions for this panel?
I have one small question. And either one of you might not be able to answer it, and maybe somebody who's going to testify will be. But on the 10% rule of the community has less than 10% of affordable housing, who keeps score on that? Does the municipality keep score on that, or who makes a determination that it's 10%?
Madam Chair, Representative Dierman, I'm going to punt on that one.
Yep.
Okay.
We'll have someone who could probably answer that. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have Sean Cleave and Becky Steckler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'll be brief. For the record, Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I just want to illustrate kind of the market economy for real estate. You have 4 phases, recovery, expansion, hypersupply, and recession. However, in Oregon, we've never had hypersupply. It's a function of our land use system. It's a function of the home builders being homegrown, the development being small within pockets of communities. We don't have master plan communities, which unfortunately is something that the market actually demands. Our number one growing segment and number one purchasers of houses currently is the millennials, and they want single family detached in the suburbs, which is a little bit ironic considering what you hear from the Portland area, that everybody wants to live in the Pearl District. So, you know, when we're looking at House Bill 2007, I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. I don't think we're ever going to get to a point in Oregon where we have hypersupply. But from the perspective of that lag in permitting time for affordable housing, if you're reaching the end of the cycle and you've hit the point where lending starts to decrease, that affects the affordable housing units disproportionately because they need the penciling an affordable housing project is really, really minding your P's and Q's on the budget, and you pull the plug on those developments sooner than later, and lending dries up sooner than later in that cycle. Those of you who know me, I have three children, and as a father, it's my job to educate them on the weekends and evenings. Sometimes they read books in the mornings, too. But on Saturdays, I like to play a game. It's called Go Get Me a Rock. And when they bring the rock back, I say, well, that's not the rock I'm looking for. And usually by the third rock, they're either onto a new game or throwing rocks at me. So that's my illustration of the permitting process, and happy to work on this bill with the speaker. Thank her for bringing it forward, and I will end my testimony and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. I'm Becky Steckler with the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. And we're neutral on the bill, but I'm definitely we're thinking through how you would actually implement it. And there's a number of issues that have come up that would probably benefit from additional amendments. And the first is related to the expedited review of affordable housing projects and that 120-day or 150 for counties. And definitely concerns from local jurisdictions, again, most of which are pretty strapped for resources, and the impact not only on being able to process an application within 30 days, but then also what happens to all the other applications that that jurisdiction is also considering, and the impact that that could have on that. So it's, you know, so many of Oregon's jurisdictions definitely are challenged to be able to comply currently. And so I would just like to emphasize the resources that would be needed there. Also, to answer the question, Representative Nierman, about that what percentage of a community's housing is affordable, to do that you have to do a housing needs analysis, which is an analysis that, of course, happens when a city wants to expand its urban growth boundary or look to see if it needs to expand its urban growth boundary. Very few cities have a regularly updated housing needs analysis. Probably metro areas, the only place that is required to do that on a regular basis, and no other, the other jurisdictions are not. And so it's highly unlikely that a local jurisdiction outside of Metro is going to have a pretty good sense of the percentage of housing that it has, kind of depending on how much growth that they're actually having when they did their housing needs analysis. But so much of that kind of information is pretty outdated currently. And also, a couple weeks ago, I testified on DLCD's budget, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And, of course, the governor's budget recommends that all of the technical assistance grants and some other grants that would normally go towards updating the comprehensive plans and doing the kind of analysis that we're talking about, she has recommended that all be focused on the coast for resiliency and preparing for the Cascadia event. So as well, DLCD's budget is being recommended to have approximately three fewer staff. So while resources are actually being taken away from both local jurisdictions and the department to help with this kind of work, it places a greater burden on those local governments, especially smaller jurisdictions that don't have those resources. And I just have to say, a week and a half ago, I spent a full Saturday in the community of Willamina and on a volunteer planning project that the chapter did with them. And I spent an evening talking to a former planning commissioner and a current planning commissioner, and they were excited because they had spent, this is how few resources this community has, they spent the last 3 years meeting every Monday to update their development code. And, of course, their comprehensive plan, I don't think they've looked at that since it was originally approved, but their development code they use on a somewhat regular basis, and it was so outdated. And they didn't have the resources to hire someone else to come in and do it. And they were pretty excited because they think they were almost done. And if they continue to meet for the next year, then they might be able to finish that off. So it, just to give you a flavor of kind of what some of these, especially small jurisdictions, are being challenged with. Let's see. Along those lines, we were also concerned about the requirement that only one housing unit or one unit being affordable for, you know, an apartment building or a larger development, and what would that do? You know, would that just be a new segue to getting up to the front of the line and pushing everybody else back? And then also, I guess I wanted to raise the point that there is a fair amount of nuance in local zoning codes, and given that this would be applicable statewide, there's just concerns in thinking through what the Oregon Housing and Community Services would be recommending for the different zones that would be appropriate for the different housing types, and just saying, you know, single family or multifamily. Most cities are just slightly different, and it's probably just that slight amount of difference that would make it difficult to just plop down housing. And not to say that that it couldn't be worked out, but definitely there's potential for difficulty kind of in that realm that should really be thought through, and maybe even thinking about looking at some really different jurisdictions and how would it play out. So some concerns along those lines.
Yeah. So really,
let's see here. And then I think I had my question. I was looking at the bill again about the church properties, and that those would be inside of incorporated cities and not necessarily outside in unincorporated areas, if I've read that correctly. And so again, just making sure that all of that the necessary services, and that it would be appropriate to have the density that might be desired on church properties would really be kind of appropriate in the locations where they're actually exist. And with that, I will end my testimony, and I'm welcome to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions? Okay. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2007, open a public hearing on House Bill 2316. This is a very related area. Kathy, could you read us a summary? And while you're doing that, could we please have Ellen Miller, Marianne Nash, and John Chandler? And Becky Steckler, if you want to all come, we'll bring up another chair and just do it quickly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2316 requires a city outside a metropolitan area with a population less than 25,000 to determine, estimate housing needs, inventory supply of buildable lands, and adopt measures to accommodate estimated housing need for periodic or legislative review of the comprehensive plan, applying the statewide planning goal related to buildable lands for residential use.
Marianne Nash, John Chandler. John Chandler, come on up. And Becky Steckler. We'll just have all four and try to bang it. Thank you, Rep. Lyle. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ellen Miller with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to talk to you about our department's bill, House Bill 2613. Cassie did a good job introducing the bill, and I also wanted to point out we have a one-pager on OLIS that kind of gives the background and some details on the bill. This is really a simple bill. It is a statutory fix, or I should say it is, what it does is it codifies our rule in statute, and it really fixes a discrepancy. So what the bill does is it requires cities that have a population of less than 25,000, when they voluntarily enter into periodic review or legislative review of their comprehensive plans, they must do a housing needs analysis. What this means is that they need to look at their current supply and their forecasted demand. And if the demand is greater than their current supply, they need to implement some measures to address that demand. So right now, there's a discrepancy in statute because in 1995, this was codified for cities with a population of over 25,000. There was a court case in 2008 where the Court of Appeals ruled that if the legislature intended for the smaller cities to also be required to fulfill these measures or to implement these measures when identified, that the legislature would have codified it as well. So we're asking you today to consider codifying our rules. So just to be clear, in our rules, all cities are required to implement these measures when identified needs arise. Again, this is not an unfunded mandate in that it really only becomes it's triggered by cities' actions. So these smaller cities are not required to do these reviews, but when they do these reviews and they determine that there is a need, they must implement some measures for the need. So we ask for you to fix this discrepancy, consider this codifying this rule, and I'm available for any questions. Thanks so much.
Great. Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, Becky Steckler with the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. And I'll be brief because we agree with the department's analysis and think that this is a good bill to support. And would just again echo that it's definitely not an unfunded mandate, but that more resources will result in better analysis, more analysis happening, and better both comprehensive plans and work done so that we can really build great communities across the state. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, again here in support of House Bill 2316, and with a fair amount of chagrin because the statute that the court, in my opinion, misinterpreted was one that I helped write back in the 90s, and we certainly did not intend to have small cities not have to do housing needs analysis. That was the sort of argument that only fools lawyers apparently and did. This bill in front of you will, from our perspective, make the law say what we thought it said from the first, which was that when jurisdictions are looking at their UGBs, they have to do a housing needs analysis regardless of the size of jurisdiction, except for the statutory carve-out for under 2,500 cities and 15,000 counties. Good bill. Should pass. Sorry about the poor drafting 20 years ago.
Okay, any questions for this panel? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Curious, what's the average cost that we're talking about that cities are going to have to take on to do this?
Right now, I do not have an analysis of what the average cost is for these smaller cities. I have put that request in to the agency to get some numbers to follow up on that.
Okay.
And if I may, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Noble, it really depends on the size of the jurisdiction, too. And as well, we have a new streamlined UGB process that's supposed to help make it less expensive, make it quicker, but that hasn't been no one's used that new process yet, so it's still kind of to be determined what it would actually take. But they're not cheap. They're not cheap.
And there is going to be another bill for your agency that has to do with funding extra positions, right? So that's not up for a hearing right now, but we will be revisiting this issue.
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, that is actually not one of the agency's bills, but a strong advocate of the work that we do. So
Okay.
We're happy to hear that.
Yep.
If I could just follow, the reason I ask is I understand that the court case actually came out of a city not wanting to pay for one of these. So with the recent ruling. So I'm just curious what that cost is, if it was enough to actually take it to court.
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Representative Noble, it was from Madras, and I can get more information on the actual court case and what kind of the findings were. I don't have those available right now.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alan, maybe you can answer this. This is in the context of this situation, a city has already undergone a comprehensive review, right? And they've already spent money on that. And so I think the issue is that they've got the results, but now they're not implementing a new plan, which will be another step further. But they've already expended income voluntarily, or expended, you know, funds to do this analysis. But now they have the information, and they're not taking it further and making a continued analysis. Is that correct?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Meek, members of the committee, that is correct. So again, this is a volunteer action that the city would enter into. And if they were to complete that analysis and determine that need, then this, what this bill would do would require explicitly in statute that they then fulfill that, or I should say implement measures to address those needs. So yes, that is correct. They will. If they have voluntarily entered into a housing needs analysis, they have already committed some resources to that.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Maybe I'm confused. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
In reading the summary, it talks about requiring the needs analysis when they do a review of the comprehensive plan. So is this part of the comprehensive plan, or is this an addition to the comprehensive plan review?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, members of the committee, it is a part of the periodic review or the legislative review of the comprehensive plan. So they would elect to go into, and I'm sorry if I misspoke, they would elect to go into that periodic review or that legislative review of the comprehensive plan, which would trigger a housing needs analysis, which would trigger potential implementation of measures.
So the first part is the voluntary part?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And so next we have Marianne Nash.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Marianne Nash, here on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. Sorry, I was next door testifying, so I apologize for my tardiness. We are here more with questions, primarily, and I have spoken with the LCD about the questions and hope to have answers to them. But our concern actually stems from some of our members in Madras who are saying, well, in Madras, we do have some supply. We do have some anticipated housing that we're building. But neighboring communities such as Culver may look at future needs and say, you know, we'll have to push on to agricultural land to develop. So we would like Madras to fill our need and folks to have a brief commute between the two places. And so we wanted to make sure that communities can still plan in that way, and particularly in rural areas where you have maybe clusters of small communities. If one of them wants to be the one that develops more while others say we're surrounded by agricultural land, we have no real easy place to develop, so we'd like to direct our development, you know, to Madras or to a nearby community. We want to make sure that that can be accommodated and that that's allowed, and so I'm working with DLCD to figure out how that would happen if you did have a community that says, you know, we're surrounded by agricultural land, but our neighboring community isn't and has some potential to develop, and so we'd like to direct our development there as well, or have that be, you know, kind of the community in the area that plans to accommodate more development or more housing in the future. So it's really a question more than anything else, but one that we're working with the LCD to address.
Any questions?
Madam
yes,
Chair. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, and just a clarification question. So if Madras is doing their own study, it doesn't take into consideration Culver or any other communities, just theirs, correct?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Meek, that is correct, and that's where I guess my confusion comes in, is how communities would even do that. But that was the concern, apparently born of experience, that our member raised, as she said, well, you know, Culver, they're surrounded by agriculture. Madras, we have a couple areas where we can accommodate some future development. I don't know if it's an intergovernmental agreement. I don't know how it would work, which is why I'm mostly just raising concerns and saying I'm not entirely certain. But that is the concern that my member raised. And I think when I asked DLCD, they were like, man, we'll look into it too. So hopefully we will have answers by the time this comes back up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. All right.
Thank you.
So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2316. And I am going to open up the next three bills for a public hearing, because I think some of you want to testify on several. Certainly a good representative here. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2937, House Bill 2938 and House Bill 2456. Cassie, could you please read all three summaries?
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2937 allows an accessory dwelling unit on land zoned either for exclusive farm use or residential, rural residential use if constructed within 100 feet of an existing single-family home and complies with county residential unit standards. House Bill 2938 allows a recreational vehicle for residential purposes on land zoned for either exclusive farm use or rural residential use if placed within 100 feet of an existing single-family dwelling and has functioning sleeping, cooking, and plumbing facilities. And House Bill 2456 allows tax-exempt nonprofit organizations or religious corporations to develop affordable housing units on lands zoned for rural residential use in collaboration with local government and nonprofit organizations. The bill requires counties with jurisdictions over zoned rural residential land to develop a process for nonprofit organizations seeking to build affordable housing units and defines affordable housing units as development of two or more housing units rented at a maximum rate of 30% of the median family income within the county the housing units are built. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Thank you. Well, Chair Kennegar, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin, here to in favor of all three of the bills that we just opened up. And I want to, I served 4 years on this particular committee, spent over a year and some change with Representative Reardon on a housing task force work group. And no matter what the conversation we had, it always came back to, we can try to do everything we can on the landlord-tenant side. It doesn't put new units in the mix. And so these bills really are about trying to find ways to increase housing stock. And you will probably hear from folks who I would put in the land use purist camp that we can't possibly do some of these things because it might upset the apple cart on farmland or rural residential. And I really don't believe in all of the years and time I have spent reading on about our land use laws and our system of land use laws, which, by the way, most states have not bothered to follow and or don't have some of these housing crises that we're in. That the intent was to have people be homeless, that the intent of our land use system was to not have enough housing stock to house our people. And maybe when they passed the original land use laws, if they'd kept up the sign that said you can visit but we don't want you to stay here, then that system would work. But that's not what we have. We have a lot of people who want to come to Oregon and live here and be part of this beautiful, wonderful state. We don't have a place to put them. We know that we are somewhere, depending on whose estimate you talk about, upwards in the metro area of 80,000 units short. We also saw this weekend a paper in the an article in the Oregonian that said with some of the new housing units that have come online in Portland, there's starting to be a slight cooling of rental prices. So we know that when we put supply into the system, that you will solve the demand issue. And so we know we need to find ways to try to figure out how and where to site those 80,000 units. I do not believe any of these three bills actually upsets the land use apple cart in any kind of significant way, but it does put options and choices in for counties who would like to participate in this types of models of housing. So I'm going to start with the bill that I actually drafted, although I did for Commissioner Carlson, our office drafted for her, and you'll see that they are committee bills. Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources submitted them to you as committee bills on 2937 and 2938. But 2546 will be the first one that I sort of speak to. And really, this is at an issue trying to get around where can we site, particularly in rural residential, additional units and particularly additional affordable units. If you've ever been to my district, it is filled with big, beautiful spots of land that are largely housed by mega churches because that's an acceptable land use is to, in the middle of farmland, throw up a church. And so in our community, we not think that there are poverty issues in Westland and Tualatin, but our local food banks are serving almost 1,000 families in our communities at any given time. So this bill is drafted in a way to let churches and nonprofits, 501c3 tax-exempt organizations, be able to do affordable housing out in rural residential. What would that look like in a community like mine? Well, where one of the food banks is sited, I have to believe they're on at least 20 acres.
They have water, they have sewer, so they have the issue, the things that they would need to site maybe an accessible dwelling type unit. They're across the street from some of the best schools in the state. So if you're talking about a mom with kids, the ability to put somebody into a short-term or even long-term housing situation across from wonderful schools, sited next to a food bank, sited near jobs, is to me the way we should start thinking about how we solve the issues around demographic housing issues, because I don't think housing is a one-size-fits-all. I think we actually need to look at the demographic that we're trying to serve. Trying to find a house for a homeless veteran is very different than trying to find a space for a mom with kids who's coming out of a domestic violence situation. This bill also says nonprofit. So besides siting on a church-type facility where they have a mission of serving people who are in need, what would that look like on a nonprofit property? There's a hospital in my community, and they've got some land. They might not be rural residential, but imagine a space like that where on a Saturday night, Sally gets the hell beat out of her, and she goes to the emergency room. It would be really interesting to me to talk to my local hospital that's a nonprofit and see if they'd be willing to site a couple, two, three accessory dwelling units at the hospital so that when she leaves that hospital, she has a safe place to go for the night. So that's where we start thinking about, for me, on housing issues, how do you solve the demographic need? I'll have another bill up later in this week around senior housing, but senior housing, student housing, homeless housing, transitional housing. Our community's right near the women's prison. When my sister came out of prison, she went to a program called Bridges to Change that was in our community. And I have to say, as great of a job that they were doing, it was not the place for her to go. She immediately began using again, and shortly thereafter, she died. So having the right type of housing as we are transitioning people out of our prison system, and I just came from another bill where we were talking about extending our prison housing and reentry task force and trying to keep that alive going into another biennium, to me is really a challenge. And so when I look at this particular bill, the ability to give nonprofits and faith-based organizations a way to extend their mission through a land use fix is really critical piece about solving that those demographical housing challenges. So the bill does speak about to the notion that we need to make sure that these units are affordable. We've set some income requirements in there as well. We have put in this bill that they could a church could collaborate with other government agencies or nonprofits because maybe your local church or nonprofit is not in the business of doing housing, but there are plenty of nonprofits that are experts. And so we want to make sure that we have the ability for them to have a relationship with somebody who has land. Because in my district, a half an acre of dirt is about $500,000, and you're not building anything affordable there. And we talk about wanting to have affordable housing and communities like this, but when our land use system is constrained in a way that it is artificially driving up the cost of land, there will be no affordable housing in Lake Oswego or Westland or Tualatin that's reasonable, that is accessible on a bus line, that is near good schools and near jobs in their community, because the price of an acre of dirt does not allow for it. So when you have land that is already held in trust in a church or a nonprofit, it's a great way to come up and think about ways to we can have a partnership where the land cost is already absorbed, and we're really talking about now the cost of siting new units and creating a mechanism to either do that as part of their faith-based mission, or in the case of saying we're going to charge some level of rent, that those rents are affordable, because we've taken the land use cost out of the equation, and in most cases we've taken a lot of the sort of systems and development construction costs out of the equation, because those facilities already are connected to water and sewer and some of the things that are high cost drivers of new construction. So I think this is an important bill because it puts choice in the system. On the other two bills, similar concepts around accessory dwelling units and recreational vehicles on farmland or rural residential. And these came out of Marion County, and I see that there are folks from Marion County behind me who I'm sure are going to testify. But just briefly, if you're driving here from Portland every day, there's a spot on I-5, and it's on the right-hand side as you're going southbound. And it's sort of like a side road, like a service road, and there's a kind of a driveway there. And I have driven this road to the Capitol every day. This is my seventh term coming into this body, and I've never missed a day of school. So when I drive by that every day, I look at that because it's a spot where people are parking a recreational vehicle because they have nowhere else to park it for the night. And I was in Portland recently dropping my child off at a dance, and we found a place to go get ice cream. cream, and it took us under sort of like the southeast division and under a bridge, and there was an RV parked there as part of the homeless encampment that was there. And so when I look at a bill, particularly on that RV side section, being able to site something and getting it off the street, getting it into a safe place. If we need a land use exemption for that, nobody's saying go and build RV parks and farmland with this bill. This is talking about putting one unit on one site and giving some people the opportunity to not have what is currently their home sited on the side of the road or on the side of the freeway. That is not where we want people sleeping at night. So I think that the two bills that Commissioner Carlson, who's is a member of our ABC task force and has spent a lot of time digging into these two bills and coming up with something that is situational for certainly for her county, but could also be borrowed for other counties, I think are important pieces of this puzzle as well. And again, nobody's saying, you know, fill farmland with ADUs and fill them with RVs. And we are talking about not like camper trailers and things. We're talking about things that you could actually hook to plumbing and like an Airstream, but giving people some flexibility to put new places for people to land and sleep and put their head at night. We know that if folks don't have a home, they are more likely to be in our social service system, more likely to be in our justice system. Their kids are missing school and are falling behind every day. So we can have a conversation about beautiful farmland in Oregon, and I appreciate that as a native, lifelong Oregonian, but I really don't believe that that was the intention of our land use laws. And there are going to be folks who totally disagree with that, but I do not believe Governor McCall was ever somebody who wanted to see folks homeless in our state. He wanted a beautiful state, but he didn't want people sleeping on the side of the freeway.
Thank you very much, Representative Parrish. We have a lot of people to testify on particularly two of the bills. Approximately 12 people, approximately 48 minutes left. I'm hoping you can all keep it to 4 minutes or less.
If there are no questions.
Oh, are there any questions for Representative Parrish?
I have one little one. So I appreciate
that. Quick question,
that.
Because we want to make sure that the other 12 people get to testify.
Good. So I like that Bill 2456. I think that hits right at the slice that's needed of the type of housing. But just as kind of a little issue is I noticed that you have a definition of affordable housing in there, and there's other definitions that are different definitions for affordable housing in other bills that are proposed, and I suspect that there's already someone in statute somewhere. Then it would be nice, neater, and tidier if we maybe had one definition of affordable housing somewhere. Maybe we could look to that.
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Nearman, I am happy to make this congruent to anything else that we are currently considering so that we don't have a mismatch of what that means, and so happy to entertain whatever kind of amendment it would take to build some congruency into the bill.
Good. I'll talk to you offline about that.
There we go.
Thank you. And I was just going to say that some of the bills are driving at different things. The House Bill 2007 with construction of new housing, a lot of that is looking at workforce housing. Actually, I think it only goes up to 60%, so it's more affordable. But sometimes we're looking at affordable housing, affordable for workforce, so that will often go up to 80%. This, you're looking at rental units, and so you're looking at a really low-income population as well.
Yeah.
Perhaps because it's connected to a nonprofit.
Yeah, Chair Kennegeier, that is really sort of the piece of this for me, is that we are looking at sort of that faith-based, nonprofit-based
very
mission, where
very
their goal
income.
Isn't to be necessarily a landlord. We obviously want to make sure that operational costs of running those types of units are met and doing that through rent, but also that we know that there are folks who, when they are transitioning out of the justice system, they're coming out of domestic violence, that their ability to pay sort of market-based rents is going to be really, really difficult. So to me, this is an opportunity, whether it's, you know, a type of unit that's 6 months or a year, that just gives somebody that stepping stone, the ability to build a savings account so they can move on to the next phase of their life, or, you know, finish up the last few credits of school, whatever it's going to take to get them moving in life, that rent is not necessarily the thing that is keeping them from being successful.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. So first up, we have Kevin Cameron, Barb Young, Renee Glass, and Brandon Reich. So feel free to bring up a chair. Yeah. It's good to see my old colleague.
Yes.
Former Representative Cameron.
Chair Kennegeier, it's always good to be here, and it's always good to get out.
You were a big supporter of Children's Toxics. I still remember that.
Yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, it's good to be here. For the record, Kevin Cameron, Marion County Commissioner. And today I want to introduce a few people that are here with me to talk about House Bill 2937 and 2938. And Renee Glass is here with us, and she is a resident citizen, and love to have her kick us off with her personal testimony of one of the reasons we're here.
And can you state your name for the record?
Yeah. I'm Renee Glass. Good morning. And thank you for taking the time to listen to us on this. I live in EFU property in Marion County in Almsville. I purchased property a little over a year ago. And there's existing parking and shop and stuff on the property where there had previously been an RV pad. And I had a friend who, you know, came on hard times. She got laid off her job, had a daughter with diabetes. And I was sympathetic to her situation because I'd been there like 15 years ago. So I let her park on my property. And about 3 or 4 weeks after she parked there, I got a letter from Marion County saying that she had 2 weeks to move and they were going to fine me in excess of $1,000. And I was like, first of all, I had no idea I was doing anything wrong. And if you drive around in my neighborhood, it's almost, I would say it's more the norm than the exception that there's an RV on somebody's property that someone's living in. You know, she's got back on her feet again. She's doing good. Whatever. I have another neighbor on one side of me. He had a 15-year-old son. They were homeless, and they were living in an RV. And I have another neighbor on the other side of me who is a disabled veteran, and he lives on his grandparents' property in an RV. You know, I don't know where these people would be if they weren't there. I feel bad for them. Sorry. Excuse me. Okay. You know, they'd be on the street like the other lady was talking about on the side of the road, moving around. I'm just trying to help them out. I'm not making anything off of this, and I don't think any of these other people are either. I just got a letter this last week. Marion County's coming out to inspect me tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And they want me to get permits for plumbing that was already there. I don't have any idea how I would even do that. When I bought the property, Marion County came out, and they made me dig up the septic and pump it and, you know, distribution boxes and all of this stuff. They said it was okay. So when I bought the property, there were 7 people living in the house. I'm the only one there now. I don't know how I could possibly be taxing the system. So that's it.
Thank you very much for your story.
So, Madam Chair, that's what kind of triggered. We were between, I guess, a rock and a hard place at Marion County. We had looked into the statute and only allowed basically an RV to be parked for 120 days. And so Commissioner Carlson, who's unable to be here with us today, worked with Representative Parrish, and I believe Representative Clem filed these bills in his committee, and they're now before us. With me today is also Barb Young, who's our government affairs person, and Brandon Reich, who's from our planning department. They can give a little bit more information. But obviously, as we know, Marion County is not immune to the homelessness issue that we have or the housing crisis that we have. And I will say this, that as commissioner and my other two commissioners, we protect farmland at all costs. And I want to make sure that that's for the record, because Marion County is the number one ag producing county farm gate in Oregon. And that is really important to us to make sure we preserve the agricultural lands that we have and ability to produce that. So, currently, the real issue here is that there's no statute that prevents this from occurring today. It's by rule with LCDC. Under Goal 14, it sets a limit of one dwelling per parcel. The bill has some sideboards. You could see that the ADUs or the RVs, depending on which bill you're looking at, would be within a certain amount of feet of an existing dwelling. So it's not, they're going to spew out onto EFU farmland. It would be actually in the actual acreage where there would be a house today. And the last thing I'll say, I'm going to skip over some of the things I have, but there was a case study done by HUD that found the average family size for ADUs is just over one, and the average family size in the main house is just over two. So it's not, and we heard from Renee, her situation, I'm sure we're going to run into situations where there's a lot of people living in one house, but what that study says is that this is not high density of population. So I'll turn it over to Barb Young. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be available for questions.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barb Young, Government Relations Manager for Marion County. Since Commissioner Carlson couldn't be here today, she did ask that I read her testimony into the record, and I'll try to make it as quick as I can. Many thanks to the committee for hearing House Bill 2937 and House Bill 2938 today. I regret I can't be here to testify in person. This past year, I served as co-chair of the Mid-Willamette Homeless Initiative. Four local jurisdictions spent a year working on proven strategies to work on the homeless issue in our area. We had eight subcommittees, a huge inclusion of advocates, service providers, educators, and public officials, and we surveyed and interviewed 57 people who had been homeless. The first on the list of strategies is to increase the supply of affordable housing. There are simply not enough places for people to live, especially for people with limited means. Strategies include building more homes and apartments and also scrutinizing local regulations and remove barriers and add incentives. Imagine my surprise when I was contacted in the midst of this. KPTV was working on a story. They had been contacted by a person living in an RV in rural Marion County who had permission to live there by the homeowner. Someone had filed a complaint. Code enforcement sent a letter giving the person 2 weeks' notice to find a new place to live with the risk of a $1,025 fine. Of course, we took this situation to heart. Our code enforcement officers were simply following state law and county code. Actually, as Commissioner Carlson said, or Cameron said, state law is silent on ADUs and RVs in farmland, but it authorizes DLCD to create goals and administrative rules. One of those rules says one dwelling per parcel in farm zones, and that drives all of our county-related policies. While each county handles things a little bit differently, here's how Marion County handles that. You have a guest house, but it can't have a working restroom, and for many years could only have a microwave and a small refrigerator, but no stove. Guest houses are okay because they aren't defined as a second dwelling. Or you can live in an RV or a manufactured dwelling on rural property if you are a caretaker. That requires a doctor's note. As soon as the caretaking situation is resolved, the RV or manufactured home has to be removed from the property. While allowing ADUs and RVs on rural residential farm properties won't be the silver bullet to solving the housing supply problem, it is an important tool in the toolbox. House Bill 2937 and House Bill 2938 set the state policy that ADUs are allowed and also set necessary sideboards. And the sideboards would be only one ADU parcel, only one ADU per parcel. And there already has to be a home on that lot or parcel. And the county would be required to regulate health and safety matters like electricity, septic, and water supply. My guess is that there are hundreds of these living situations currently existing around the state for which health and safety concerns cannot be taken care of through the county permit process. I think it's important to not muddy the state policy too much with too many details and allow the details to be developed by the counties. Recognize that when the counties amend their codes, it must be noticed and approved by DLCD. Both bills are endorsed by the Association of Oregon Counties, and I want to thank Representative Julie Parrish for her help in getting the bills drafted and Representative Brian Clem for filing them as committee bills. I have heard one concern raised that this legislation could create the potential for short-term rentals in farm zones. I'm happy to support a committee amendment to add another sideboard. if it's needed. However, I'm hopeful the bill will retain both residential and farmland provisions. The Marion County situation featured on KPTV was on farmland, not rural residential. So stripping the bill of farmland provision won't solve that issue. Second, our planners tell us that rural residential is defined somewhat differently around the state and that ADUs are actually more feasible on farmland than on rural residential. Our planner Brandon Wright can speak to that. Third, any county wanting to create codes more stringent than state law can certainly do so. I appreciate the committee's favorable consideration. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, I am Brandon Reich, staff representing the Planning Division of Marion County. Currently in law, there are no means for a county to adopt provisions to allow an accessory dwelling unit on property in a rural area. These House Bills 2937 and 2938 give counties the option to permit accessory dwelling units if they choose on some rural land, rural residential land, and farmland. The bill calls it rural residential, and while every county calls their rural residential zone differently, slightly, I think the intent is that it would apply to land that counties have designated for rural residential development in their comprehensive plans. The bill includes some basic sideboards in it, and counties would be able to adopt additional standards particular to the needs of their own county in order to implement health and safety concerns and standards, as well as community preferences for how accessory dwelling units will look in their county. The individual adoption of standards is different from having the Land Conservation and Development Commission attempt to establish one set of standards that cover the entire state. The Department of Land Conservation and Development will still review local code when counties adopt it to ensure the accessory dwelling unit code is consistent with other zoning and planning requirements. In some ways, placing accessory dwelling units on farmland will be easier than placing them on rural residential land. Parcels in farm zones tend to be larger, so there can be adequate room to place an accessory dwelling unit near an existing dwelling and utilize an existing septic system, for instance. Clustering the additional dwelling unit near the existing dwelling is intended to minimize any impact these units could have on surrounding farmland and farm activities. It is also the intent of this bill that once the use is in the local county code, the jurisdiction would perform a land use review before an accessory dwelling unit is placed to ensure it meets the standards the county put in their code and is compatible with surrounding uses and other aspects that the county wishes to review. With that, I'm available for any questions you may have.
Any questions for this panel?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Yes. Just, Kevin, you might not be the right one to ask, Janet might be, did anybody approach the department regarding this to have them consider changing their administrative rule?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, first of all, I want to tell you that Commissioner Carlson is a teacher and a professor. Commissioner Brentano is a garbage hauler, and I'm a hamburger flipper, so you know who the smartest one in the room is. I do not know the answer to your question if she contacted the department or not. Brandon?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Legislator Olson. There are two counties, at least, who have expressed, Deschutes County and Benton County, who have expressed an interest in accessory dwelling units in the past and have that interest in their comprehensive plans. So there were discussions that I'm not purview to the details, but there was nothing forthcoming from the department. There were some means forward.
Yeah. I don't remember him flipping hamburgers either.
I know he has big barbecues. You have big barbecues. I've heard about your barbecues. So I'm curious about the 2-week notice, and yet you're allowed by rule to have 120 days.
They said that the trailer had been there since January. When in fact it hadn't, it was my horse trailer that had been parked there. And so they just assumed it had been there. Well, they had an aerial shot or something, and they thought it was the same trailer. Okay. She'd actually only been there at the time about 3 weeks. But And that's why they said it had been there in excess of the 120 days. And in the case of the neighbors and several other properties in that area, I know of one that's been there for years. Mm-hmm. So,
and they haven't gotten the same kind of notice that you...
You know, they won't really tell me. It's just they only tell me about my own property.
Okay.
Madam Chair, it's a complaint-driven process, basically. Somebody mm-hmm. complains, and code enforcement goes out and takes a look and does an investigation. And this came up, I think this came up last summer or last. We've been holding off on our code enforcement to try to work towards this, but we'll have no options unless we get some action from the legislature. So that's where we're at. Okay. And it is a complaint-driven process.
Okay. Thank you very much. So next we have Mike McCarthy, Marianne Nash, and Mary Kyle McCurdy.
Oh, go ahead. Just checking them off.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee, once again, Marianne Nash here on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. First off, I want to say that we absolutely support affordable housing and certainly sympathize with the stories that we've heard today. But as you heard a little bit earlier, the solution isn't to site affordable housing on farmland. We have big concerns about whether any of these dwellings would actually end up as affordable housing. I think it's much more likely they'd end up as Airbnbs or other short-term rentals, particularly in some of the amenity areas like Hood River, Dundee area, those areas. One of the biggest reasons for this is our entire land use planning system exists to allow agricultural uses in agricultural areas, urban uses in urban areas, and kind of the rural residential areas is a bit of a buffer in between. When you get out into the rural areas, there aren't the services that are needed, particularly for affordable housing. Emergency services take much longer and much more expensive to provide. There's no water sewer systems. We have groundwater restrictions on a lot of the state. And so there's concerns about taxing groundwater resources. We already have a lot of groundwater issues due to septic management. And so we would be further taxing those resources by siting additional dwellings. Certainly could result in taking farmland out of production. As I was driving down here today, I was actually noticing the areas where, you know, the farming is right around the home site, and you'd be directly going onto farmland to site additional dwellings. One of our members raised concerns with, particularly with long-term RV parking, how would that be factored into the county tax code? Would those properties be assessed? What would that look like? And others have said that they live in counties where the counties have granted extensions for RVs when there has been cases of hardship. If there's a big construction project coming through town and there's not enough housing supply, they've said, okay, you can re-up your 120 days. I believe the amount varies by county. So there are other solutions to these issues, and we'd encourage the committee to look at those. One of the biggest reasons that we try to keep farm uses in farm zones is because of the high level of conflict we've seen. There's already been hundreds of new dwellings, largely for non-farm use, sited at EFU lands, I think largely under existing zoning provisions that allow one home per, depending on where you're in the state, 80 acres or 320 acres. And in those areas, we have seen in the last couple of years, I would say a tenfold increase in calls from neighbors saying, man, you know, my neighbor called ODA, they called DSL, they called whomever over my normal farming practice. They had to come inspect. They told me I was okay. Or my neighbor's complaining because I'm out combining at 6 a.m. That's what I have to do to harvest. And so when you start to bring more and more non-farm folks out into farm areas, you can have a lot more of this kind of conflict, whether it's calling in complaints, whether it's a huge increase in traffic incidences with tractors as folks are trying to move between fields, particularly during harvest. We see one or two folks that feel like they are this close to a fatal accident every year, particularly during harvest season. Long story short, and I will be brief, we very much support the need for additional affordable housing and certainly even parking recreational vehicles in extraordinary circumstances. We believe there's a path for counties to look at changing their time frames or providing some flexibility in that, and certainly would support that. But in terms of permanent residences for folks not affiliated with the farm, it's just not the best use of farmland. It's not an answer to the affordable housing issue. There's not transportation
transportation facilities. Our existing roads can't handle it. And we think it would just cause even more strain on farmers in that area without really answering an affordable housing need. So thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is Mike McCarthy. I'm from Parkdale, Oregon. I would like you to oppose allowing any additional housing units on EFU if they're not farm related. I'm from Hood River County. I raise apples, pears, cherries, cows, and some timber. In Hood River County, any additional any accessory dwelling units would just be converted to vacation rentals that were on farmland. We already have 400 to 500. The county's not sure how many. In the city and the county, we have 400 to 500 STRs, or vacation rentals. That's roughly 5% of the housing stock in Hood River County. We've pushed back really hard on that to prevent this in the county, because it's the people are now living in Lyle or in the Dalles, or our workforce to come. If you really want to fix this problem, you'll reduce the number of vacation rentals allowed. That would be a huge thing, and it would really fix the problem in our county. It would fix it 100%. I'm proud to be a farmer. I'm one of the 1%, or less than 1% of the people in the country that are still farmers, still make a living. I'm not a land use purist. I get up every morning and try to make a living farming. I'm aware of the huge conflicts that we go through. It's getting more and more difficult every day to farm in the farm zone. In an area like where we are, there's already way too many dwellings in the farm zone. The farm parcels are size are small. They're getting more and more difficult to farm. And in our case, we've grown our operation since I started farming in 1980, and we've grown substantially. And we bought other farms, and we have roughly 15 houses on those different farms. We have way too many farm dwellings already in the farm zone. But what we do is we use all that housing for our workers, and we house 100% of our crew. So I think the solution to this is you should require all the employers in Portland to provide housing for their workers, and I think that would solve it, because we're required to do that as farmers. But another point is that because that housing is so important, and we're not sure even as farmers that we want to put our farm worker housing on our property, we, our farm, our long-term strategy, we bought commercial property in a little community. We're going to put our farm worker housing on commercial property because we don't want it on the farm. Farmland is too valuable. And we think that by farming those acres that we would put farm labor housing on, we can make enough additional income to pay for that off-site housing and commercial property. The other thing is housing will take good farmland out of production. These ADUs will take good farmland out of production. It doesn't seem like a lot of land, but if you figure it out, it's roughly 2 acres. The land use planner from Marion County stated that you could use the same septic tank. Well, of those 15 units I have never had one that was approved that I built new for my workers where I could use the same septic tank. So that doesn't happen. So it takes about 2 acres to put an ADU on a piece of farmland. By the time you have the house, the garage, the yard, the utilities, the septic tank, and the drain field, which is huge depending on the soil type, takes about 2 acres out of production every time you put in a new unit. And I think there's better places to put it than on good farmland. The other thing is that if you have a new unit, you have to have a safety zone around that unit now, and you have to have several hundred feet. A flail mower will throw a stick 200 feet. So if you've got kids playing in the yard, you really want to be a long way away from there. The other thing is there's a new law by EPA that says that you have to have 100-foot distance between wherever you're spraying and any people. So if they're on the side of the yard, it could be, you know, 150 feet from that actual where the house is that you cannot farm anymore. And that's getting to be a real difficult problem. And one example of an incompatibility, and there's lots of them, a farmer was, some kids from a neighboring house had come into an orchard, sat down by a tree, fell asleep by a tree. The farmer came along with a flail mower. The grass was tall, way too tall, 2 or 3 feet tall. The farmer almost did not see those kids sleeping until they got right on them with that flail mower. So that's just one example. We see these types of things all the time. There are people in the farm zone from a house nearby that come into the orchard. So an ADU is not only an issue for that farmer, it's an issue for all the farmers around that because you're adding people into that zone. The other thing in our county, our planning department has not been able to get on top of the issue of STRs. They don't have enough enforcement. They don't have enough staff. They cannot find where they are. And by adding more ADUs in the farm zone, they don't have the budget to enforce this, and it just makes it more difficult. On the RV issue, we would never be allowed as farmers to put our workers in an RV. We would get fined thousands of dollars by OSHA if we put a worker in an RV. So why is it now your idea to put people in RVs when it's totally illegal for us to do that? And I guess if you're going to go the RV route, I would hope you would loosen up the laws that for farmers so we can put people in. I don't want to put them in that type of housing, to be honest with you. And I am very sensitive to the problem of affordable housing and homelessness, and it's something that weighs on me all the time. That's why we spend all of our extra money on the farm to house our people. And it's very common in the Hood River Valley. Many, many farmers have spent $500,000 in the last 10 years or $1 million in the last 10 years to build good housing for their people. So we house our people. We just don't believe that non-farm housing should be in the farm zone. And if you think about it, in 2050, they say there's going to be 10 billion people in the world. And those states and countries who make sure they protect farmland with water are going to be in the economic driver's seat. And those that don't, those that always have another reason, another use to put on farmland are going to be in a different situation. So I really hope you won't put any more units in the farm zone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming from so far away.
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Mary Kyle McCurdy, Deputy Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. We're here to oppose both the bills before you. The 2937 allows accessory dwelling units on the same lot as an original house as an outright use in rural residential areas and as a conditional use on EFU land. And 2938 does the same thing for RVs. Although we believe these bills will not accomplish their stated objective and might well be counterproductive to affordability and will cause unintended but significant consequences, as you've heard some. 2937 states it's about accessory dwelling units, but the definition is not actually of an accessory dwelling unit. Rather, it's of a standalone house on the lot. Typical ADU definitions require the ADU to be smaller in size than the host house. The owner must live in one or the other of the two dwellings. Many cities require the ADU to be actually inside the existing home and not a separate structure. And many prohibit short-term rentals. This bill has none of those restrictions, and it also doesn't require it to be affordable or available only to those of a certain income level or below. Therefore, these bills simply allow another dwelling in exclusive farm use zones. And you've heard Mike McCarthy describe the impact of those, but I want to give you a little picture of the full impact of this across Oregon's farmland. Oregon's land use laws already permit various types of both farm and non-farm dwellings in exclusive farm use zones. And in fact, the agricultural community thinks it's too generous already because of the conflicts that arise when city folk live in the countryside. According to the biennial reports that DLCD does on farm and forest lands, in the 2014-2015 time span, over 500 dwelling units were approved on farmland across Oregon, both farm and non-farm. Between 1986 and 2015, almost 23,000 dwelling units were permitted on farmland in Oregon, both farm and non-farm dwellings, many not associated with farm use at all. 23,000 more housing units. That's quite a bit. That's just on the farmland. the rural residential areas, and just to give you a picture of that, rural residential areas are areas outside urban growth boundaries that have some level of development on them that makes most of them, not all of them, unavailable for farm or forestry. There are over 700,000 acres of rural residential lands in Oregon scattered around the state. That's about the same size as the same number of acres as is inside urban growth boundaries. We have about 800,000 acres inside urban growth boundaries. Rural residential areas are quite variable in their size and zoning. Some allow one house per 2 acres. Others are one dwelling per 20 acres. That allow density varies across the state based on a variety of things, not just the farming and forestry that might be going on around it, but also groundwater and septic capacity constraints, wildfire risks, wildlife habitat, and migration routes. To uniformly allow another dwelling on every lot across these vastly different areas, if it increases the zone density, is too broad a brush. There may be some places where it's appropriate, but this is a broad brush, especially when the dwellings are not actually accessory. It's just an additional house. I'm not going to address the conflicts. You've heard that already, but agriculture is Oregon's number two industry. It's traded sector. The farm gate produced almost $6 billion, or 11% of the state's net income, or state's net product, in 2015. We would not dream of putting conflicting uses on land zoned for other industrial uses like high tech or manufacturing. Why should we address our affordable housing issues or housing issues on land zoned for our number two industry? It just doesn't make sense. We respect the concern for affordable housing that's motivated some of the proponents of these bills. We are supporting bills that have already been before you, as I understand Mr. Chandler very well described for you. We are working on bills to increase housing and affordable housing inside urban growth boundaries. But the bills before you do not require affordable housing. They're not about affordable housing. There's no definition of affordable housing in them. And they do not prohibit the housing from being used as short-term vacation rentals, which is happening, as you've heard, across Oregon's farmland now. And even if they did, these are areas that are pretty remote. It is hard to enforce them. As you've heard, some of these are... Yeah.
I want to make sure that other people get their chance to put their comments on the record.
A bill that would address affordable housing would be if you required every city in the state to allow an accessory dwelling unit in their single-family zones. Metro did that over 15 years ago for every city in the metro area, and it's working. That would be a way to actually put a lot of housing close to where people live and where transportation exists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next up we have Mark Nystrom, John Chandler, and Sean Cleave. I'm assuming everyone's putting their comments in OLIS as well, because we've still got a few people to go.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'll just get going. For the record, Mark Nystrom, Association of Oregon Counties, AOC supports House Bill 2937, House Bill 2938. I'd like to direct your attention to OLIS at some point to check out Bill Hall, Commissioner Bill Hall. He's our president. He submitted some testimony on this. Commissioner Pat Farr from Lane County also submitted some testimony on this. I just want to highlight these bills are permissive. They're not forcing anyone to put Airbnbs in farm communities when they don't want them to be there. So any county can choose to implement whatever kind of restrictions that they do want to have. So if a county says that this needs to be attached, it has to be 300 square feet or less, it can never be an Airbnb, that's their choice. And that's what the beauty of having local control is. I do highly recommend that you continue to work on these or have the other supporters work with us. We have had a stakeholder meeting. AOC has been very open to the idea of putting additional sideboards on this. And so far, we haven't really heard too much of a response. But we would love to continue to work and get these bills passed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Sean Cleave representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I won't belabor any additional points that have already been made. I will say that we are supportive of the three bills. I'm glad the commissioner illustrated that land use is a complaint-driven process. Land use enforcement is a complaint-driven process, so it's very likely that a neighbor is complaining about certain activity in a rural area.
you know, this will provide another quiver in our affordable housing toolkit. It's not a huge issue. One of the presenters said that agriculture makes up about 1% of the population, so if you multiply that out and provide an opportunity for one additional dwelling on those properties, it just doesn't make the mark that we're looking for to really kind of close the gap. Again, no reason why you shouldn't be entertaining these concepts. I think they're important conversations. Finally, these are hard decisions. When you look at the cost-benefit analysis about, you know, dealing with opposing groups on these concepts, you have to ask yourself, well, is it better to do something bold? Is it better to be bold and move forward? In 2016, we had an exceptionally modest pilot project to add 250-acre developments for affordable housing in two communities. We successfully whittled that down, excluding the three counties in the metro area, not just metro, but the three entire counties, Polk County, Marion County, a water district in Jefferson County. And when it came down to it, the few communities that remained, one which was very interested, one which definitely needs some affordable housing relief, is Hood River. And because of the Federal Gorge Commission, because of the standards in that bill that required services coming up to the UGB, effectively Hood River can't even partake in the pilot project, even if they wanted to entertain the opportunity. So when you look at bills like this, realize that in the last 30 years, the biggest residential development we've had to help drive down that supply-demand curve was action that this body took in 2013 through the land use grand bargain. That was only for Washington County, but it did increase the supply. You know, we have properties being built now. Nothing's overnight. But if we want to impact that supply-demand curve, given the current status and our lag, as the speaker effectively pointed out in her testimony earlier this morning, the opportunity to be bold is there. You're going to take political arrows either way on some of these decisions. But if there's anything that I can leave this committee with today in regard to these three bills, is number one, we're supportive, but number two, be bold.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members, John Chandler again for the Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 2456, House Bill 2937, and mumbling on House Bill 2938. With regard to the first two, several comments. Number first being, you obviously have a bunch of different takes on the identical issue. You've heard four today. There's the other one I mentioned earlier coming from the Senate. Perhaps others that haven't yet emerged on what to do, how to do ADUs outside the city limits, whether they be limited to rural residential, which we'd be fine with, or as these bills propose, putting it at including EFU as a conditional use. That strikes me as obviously there's a problem being sought to be fixed by a number of people. The various takes here, I'd be okay with pretty much any of them picked. I think it probably does commend itself to further discussion about how to put sideboards up to protect not just farmland, as mentioned by the previous panel, but also the concern that Mr. Cleave and I mentioned about not creating inadvertent rings of low-density development around existing cities. That's, I think, probably some pretty easy fixes to make, and it's certainly with the issues in front of us, there's a good committee to do that in. With regard to House Bill 2938, I'm mumbling only because we are having in other committees a discussion about tiny houses, and I'm not sure what the technical difference would be between a tiny house and an RV, but they seem pretty close. And from a home builder standpoint, we're nervous about allowing structures to be used for human habitation that aren't built to the building code, to be perfectly blunt, and this committee isn't dealing with those issues. But I think I would recommend this bill being considered with eye not just on the housing aspect of it, but also on the fire life safety aspects of it. We do have a codes process. We, in the other committees, I know we're trying to figure out a way to deal with tiny homes in that codes process. I'm a little nervous about advancing them as RVs as a separate housing type, given that they haven't gone through the fire life safety examination that a normal residential structure would. Okay. The concept I'm fine with. The concern is the code side.
Okay, yes, great. Ma'am. I'm not going to entertain any questions right now. We're going to try to squeeze in a few more people. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we've got Claire Clock, Becky Stecker, Michael Selrice, and Peggy Lynch. Why don't you come up, too? And if you can be as brief as possible.
For all those bills.
We've got two more after that, Vail and Ava. So, and I will stay and miss a little bit of my caucus meeting and invite anyone else. So you can be as brief as possible, please.
I'll go ahead and start. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Becky Steckler with the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. And I think the comments I made before really apply to these three bills as well and the considerations we've had. I will note in House Bill 2456 that there's no upper limit on the number of housing units that could be developed. So I believe, if I'm reading it correctly, it says two or more housing units. And so we would have concerns, especially in some of these rural areas. Most of them are not on sewer, are not on sewer. And so definitely, of course, being complying with current regulations around septic systems would be important. And also thinking about the people that would be going into some of these residential units and where the services that they need, whether it be schools medical facilities, other types of facilities, and also, of course, emergency services. So if they have medical issues where they, need an ambulance, how long does that take? And response times and the additional impact that has on those service providers, I think, are some issues to be considered. And I think everyone else has really talked about the different conflicts and the increase in complaints that when you do put additional people out into rural areas and the impact that has on a very critical the farm economy that we would be concerned about as well. And with that, I'll pass it over.
Thank you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the League has been here on behalf of affordable housing issues, particularly the mortgage interest deduction. We have worked long and hard in our local communities to assure that we have affordable housing. And that's where affordable housing belongs. We have worked to create in the simplified UGB rulemaking to assure, and Representative Stark is not here now, and it's really too bad, he would know the infamous Table 5 that requires cities to consider the number of issues in order to increase affordable housing in the urban area where the infrastructure is and where jobs and transportation are. The same is true with the 50-acre pilot legislation, the same thing. We made sure that cities who might choose to use that pilot project first looked inside to be sure that that's where it happened. That's where affordable housing can be. House Bill 2937 and 2938 really will not, for the most part, provide affordable housing. By the time you deal with whether or not the wells can handle the issues, whether or not the septic system can handle the issues, whether or not there's transportation available for people, if it's really affordable. And frankly, Brandon from Marion County talked about the list of steps that are needed to even get an actual unit to be located on there. The cost of that is just too great to make it realistic. These are not affordable housing bills, unfortunately. The League is promoting construction excise tax. We are working with jurisdictions regarding waivers of SDCs for truly affordable housing units. Those waivers mean that we, as the citizens of those cities, have to absorb the cost because SDCs really pay for something. But there are ways in which we can address affordable housing. These two bills are not it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Peggy.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is Clara Clock. I live in Corbett, Oregon. I'm a retired farmer, 35 years, and also a semi-retired conservation specialist. I do a preparation here, and then I listen to the testimony. And as far as the testimony, our first three panel testimonies, Peggy Lynch's testimony here, I would oppose 2937, 2938, and 2456. And when I'm you have all the details now, but I'd like to enter into the fact that there's a tragedy of the commons here, and I've noticed that in my own community, the Corbett community, where over the past 45, 50 years that I've lived in the community, that the traffic has increased phenomenally as far as just legal parcels, one house on a parcel. I would really hate to see what would happen if we allowed this type of development to go further. I also is working in Clackamas County. I see that in Clackamas County also as far as 213 going out to Molalla. The infrastructure just isn't there. The point is, and I'm getting off into the points that our former testifiers did, but as far as affordable housing for the homeless should be in the city, in the urban growth boundary where the work is available and where the services are available. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so the last two I think that we have up are Vale Fletcher and Ava Chapman. Is that right? Anyone else? I understand if people have to leave.
Oh, it's just
going to
get good here.
Yep.
All right.
Good.
No.
We've got to sell this here.
People can come back and watch it live.
Oh, yeah.
In the archive later, but yep.
Okay. I'm Vale Fletcher.
Patient.
Oh, no. It's great. And I'm here today from Savi Island, just north of Portland, Oregon. And I got up at 6 a.m. with two sick children, and I'm here. And thank you for letting me speak. So I am I'm in support of House Bill 2937. I think, as one of the first speakers says, it puts choice in the system. And I think as economies grow, choice is a good thing. I am a farmer. My partner and I are both farmers. I'm also a professor at the University of Portland. That's our stabilized income. And I study land use, most recently the Malheur Wildlife Standoff. So I have some perspective on that. I also study roadkill. So I'm also very interested in traffic and roadways, and I'm also very, very much in preserving farmland, preserving wilderness, right? But I'm also trying to make it as a farmer and a young farmer, and I think that that's a unique stakeholder perspective. And some of the things I want to say, and I'm going to talk quickly, and I apologize, I have some notes and I don't want to read too much, but I just wanted to say, yes, we would like an accessory dwelling unit for multiple reasons. One of them is short-term rental. And I don't say that I want affordable housing. I also think some of this not allowing ADUs is exclusive to people of color in the state of Oregon. I think it also excludes people with less money from living on farmland. And so I have a few perspectives on that I want to share. But I do come from a place of ultimate love of farmland and nature and biodiversity and ecodiversity. So this is not a vacation rental. This is a way to support farming for farmers, young farmers that have not bought land 35 years ago, 20 years ago in the state of Oregon. We bought our land in 2012. It's expensive to buy farmland in the state of Oregon, which makes it incredibly exclusive. So the average age of farmers in Oregon is 60 right now, right? This is a dying profession, mainly because most people that farm end up inheriting farmland, right? So there was a great study that just came out from Oregon State University Center for Small Farms. It was a report in September 2016, right? It said 24% of all Oregon farmers in 2012 were beginning farmers, down from 32% in 2002. 15% of beginning farmers are under the age of 35, right? So this is a very difficult thing to do. Mark Bittman talks about it from the New York Times, that we are really pricing out all types of access to farmland, not only for young people, but for people of color, right? I would say this is also a trend in Oregon as well. It's financially draining, and we would love an ADU so that we can support our farm. We would love it to be a rental if we had someone that wanted affordable housing. We're not looking to make millions. We're not rich. We're not even close to it. This would be a way to stabilize farm income for us, both with a short-term rental and a long-term rental. It also addresses this idea that farming is a socially isolating practice. Suicide rates in Oregon among farmers is almost double the national average, a lot having to do with the unstable economic and social isolation part of it. I also think ADUs in farmlands would allow people to age in place. I know having two young children, my partner's from England, he's a U.S. citizen as well, and when we have our parents come to visit, we are both in need of care as we farm and work very hard on the land, but also we would love to care for them. And so having an ADU, again, a small square footage close to the house, right, this would be a remarkable advantage for us as small farmers trying to make it farming in the city of Portland. So I think that some of the opposition will talk about traffic. I think that that's another issue I think it's important to consider. But in my area, ADUs are not going to be the problem. It's the large pumpkin traffic. It's the large beach traffic on Savi Island. Those are the real drain on resources. I don't think we should make ADUs the real lightning rod of what's happening. And I think that this could be a manageable, constrained bill that we could give some sort of malleability to counties to make it work not only as an affordable housing entrance, but also to support farmers. And I'm not talking about vacation rentals. I think that's a loaded phrase. I'm talking about finding innovative ways to support people that are farming, right? I'm not talking about we're not getting rich, right? But being able to rent a small space on our farm that's close to our house, right, to two people at a time is insanely supportive and stabilizing for us, right? Our ability to supply food to local local people in Portland. We run a CSA. We have a very small produce stand. We support. Yeah, done. So, I'm done.
And anything else you want to say, please put in OLIS.
That's good.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Go for it, Ava.
thank you very much for allowing us to be here and testify. I don't do this very well, and I'm extremely nervous.
Just your name for the record, though, please.
Ava Chapman.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for allowing us. The whole thing is this room would be full if everyone who knew that this was happening right now, they would have shown up in support. There are so many people out there that do not have a voice anymore. Why? Because their neighborhood associations don't listen to our input. And it's the same people that stay on the committees that make these rules mm-hmm. for 20-some years. And yet, even though we walk the road and they can tell us this was happening, two people live on my road that make these rules, help make these rules in the neighborhood association, and yet let nobody know this was happening. Our Skyline Ridge Runner neighborhood. I'm in unincorporated Multnomah County. Our Skyline Ridge Runner neighborhood, who does a publish out, they did not even let us know that this was happening. I met with land use planners just last Wednesday, it was, where there were eight people in that room to talk to them about their compliance, how they go about compliance. Not once did they mention that this was coming down, that they could go and have a voice. So I speak for those people who don't have voices, that I hope you even just move this through committee so that now that I know about it, I found out about it on Sunday, okay? And there are so many more people who need to be here, and I hope you will allow us that. So let me get to the points, which are not everyone who is going to be eligible to apply for an ADU is going to do that. It's just not going to happen. And not all ADUs are going to be used for vacation rental or even short-term rental. And it's not just an affordable housing issue, even though that might be a piece of it. Many in my neighborhood and around out there are people who have bought their property and owned it sometimes for 40 years, 20 years. The laws have changed underneath this. I listen to some of these families out there that are so confused as to what they can even do with their land or not. Is it farm? Is it forest? Can I do this? What about my ag building? I mean, it's heartbreaking. So, so many people just want to have friends or family mm-hmm. Come and stay. And that's actually going to reduce traffic because you can have all this coming and going to hotels and restaurants to do that. So but they come and they stay.
If you could just wrap up and put...
Pardon?
We all had a meeting that started at 10, so we're staying over. If you could just wrap up.
Many want workers to actually just help them, allow them to age in place. It's also stable housing for someone who might need a job, so it helps employment, someone coming in to help that family. Allows stable housing for them, allows employment for that person, and also allows stable housing for someone to age in place for the elderly, someone like me who is disabled, and it's not looking bright. And yet I'd like to say on my property, there would be, like I say, more individuals. And like I say, Metro has confused the issue, not made it easier on an unincorporated county, because being in Portland, people think they have permits. They get the permits, only to find out later, no, that didn't work. So Metro has confused the situation. So maybe a concluding thought. Thank you very much for this listening. And please,
thank you
please
so much.
Push this forward.
And please, please give your testimony to Ola.
And so it's if I can make a copy of this, this is from those people that were went before the accessory structure code amendments for Multnomah County.
We will keep this open until 5 o'clock today.
Okay.
And so anyone that wants to set anything for the record.
Okay.
Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2937, 2938, 2456, and the meeting's adjourned. Thank you. 2938, 2456, and the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.